Good day, I'm Jill Braden-Balderas with KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks for tuning in to Ask the Experts, our regular live web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with top experts. Today, we turn our attention to tuberculosis, a pernicious disease that's been around since recorded history and each year kills nearly 2 million people. Many challenges exist in controlling the TB epidemic. To start with, the vast majority of cases are in developing nations where healthcare systems need serious strengthening. When diagnostic testing is available, half of all TB cases are actually missed. And for those who end up getting treatment, it's relatively inexpensive, but must be taken for 6 months, so adherence can be difficult. And not sticking to the treatment can lead to multiple drug-resistant strains of TB, which are a growing problem. Also fueling the TB epidemic is the HIV epidemic. An HIV person is 50 times more likely to get TB, which is the primary killer of people living with HIV and AIDS. Last month, the Stop TB Partnership released its new 10-year global plan to stop TB. Some key goals of the plan include expanding access to diagnosis and treatment, halting and reversing TB incidence by 2015, having or almost having TB prevalence and death rates from a 1990 baseline by 2015, creating the first new TB drug in 40 years by 2010, and a 1 to 2 month treatment regimen by 2015, creating point-of-care rapid diagnostic testing for active TB by 2010 and for latent TB by 2012, and having a safe, effective, and affordable TB vaccine by 2015.
Thinking on the people, on the patients, the most important part of this plan is the patients. He promised better treatment, he promised better diagnostics, he promised better response from the public health community to the patients. It empowers the community.
We will be saving the 14 million people, the 50 million people who have been treated, and this will also help the reducing the morbidity and the mortality from HIV/AIDS infection.
As always, we'd like to get you involved in the show, so you can email your questions to us at ask@kaisernetwork.org, or you can call 1-888-524-7378. Here in studio to discuss the Stop TB plan and some of the key issues facing the fight against TB are Irene Cook, Division Chief of Infectious Diseases for USAID's Bureau of Global Health. She's also chair of the Stop TB Partnership's Coordinating Board. And Joanne Carter, Legislative Director for the nonprofit grassroots organization Results. She also serves as chair of the Stop TB Partnership's Advocacy, Communications, and Social Mobilization Working Group. And joining us by phone is Dr. Richard Chasen, director of the Center for Tuberculosis Research at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He's also the principal investigator for the consortium to respond effectively to the AIDS-TB epidemic. Thanks to all three of you for joining us. Before we get into the plan and specific details of the plan, I'd like to get from all of you, from your different perspectives, just to kind of set the stage for us of where we are in the TB epidemic and what actually is TB. So, Dick, if I could begin with you, what exactly is TB and why has it been so difficult to fight? Why haven't we been able to nearly eradicate it like some diseases, like smallpox or polio?
Well, tuberculosis is an infection caused by a bacterium that has some rather unique properties that make it very difficult to combat. The tubercle bacillus, the Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bug, is an infection that spread person to person, but in most people it lays dormant for many years. In fact, most people who are infected with tuberculosis never get sick. But the bug retains the ability to cause disease for decades, and therefore we have a reservoir of an estimated 2 billion people in the world who are infected with this organism and who are at risk of subsequently becoming ill. Other infections like smallpox cause disease relatively quickly, and if you don't die of the disease, you're cured of it and immune from further complications. And the spread of the disease is limited primarily to people who are readily recognizable as being ill. Tuberculosis is quite different, and therefore we have a huge reservoir that we haven't been able to eliminate and which keeps causing illness. Added to that is the HIV epidemic, which makes the risk of developing illness, as you noted, increase by 50 to 100-fold. And as a result, we have a growing epidemic, particularly in those parts of the world where HIV is very prevalent.
Now, Irene, you are the chair of the Stop TB Partnership's Coordinating Board. Can you explain to us, first of all, what the Stop TB Partnership is, who were the key stakeholders, and why was it founded?
Sure. The Stop TB Partnership came together in around the year 2000, and it brings together 400 organizations, donors, endemic countries, research institutions, technical agencies, NGOs, and individuals who are committed to eliminating TB as a public health threat. The partnership is organized by, there's a coordinating board which represents each of the major constituencies of endemic countries, regions, the patient community, donors, NGOs, and technical agencies. But then there's also a partners forum which gets together every 3 years and is open to anyone who is a member of the partnership and anyone else who is interested to talk about TB for 3 days and see where action needs to be taken and what the progress has been. There are also working groups around each of the major technical issues in TB. For example, there's one around DOTS expansion, which we tend to refer to as the mother of all the working groups, because everything does come around DOTS expansion. DOTS is the primary approach we have for tackling TB at the country level. It's also a working group on TB-HIV, multidrug-resistant TB, three research working groups, one around drug development, diagnostics, and vaccines, and then finally advocacy and communication social mobilization, which is the working group Joanne heads, which cuts across all of them.
Now, one of the key stakeholders that you mentioned are the patients and, you know, the social mobilization of the patients. Joanne, could you talk about how important it is to get patients involved in this fight against TB, and how well mobilized are they now, and how much work is there to do in that arena?
Maybe to make a broader comment, I think tuberculosis is an interesting public health issue in that there's really a public health infrastructure that exists in most countries in the world to treat TB, but that's been hugely important, and it's a hugely important base to build on. But I think TB is an area where there has been progress, but there's much more to be done to engage all of civil society, what we would call, you know, in the world civil society, but all of the broader partnerships to get really involved in calling on governments in countries with high rates of TB to be more engaged in making their own investment, but also the U.S. and other donors to be playing more of a role in this. So I just think we're just beginning, in a sense, to move into some of the areas that certainly the AIDS community and others have made much more progress. In terms of the patient, the community of people that have actually had TB, and in many cases been cured of TB, in some cases folks with multi-drug resistant TB that are still struggling with that, and of course people that are infected with HIV/AIDS who have had TB as well. Hugely important to do more to get that community involved, and that community is already playing a really important role. Everything from they're the people that know best about what are the gaps in treatment, like what needs to be done to improve treatment, outreach to other patients, and as well as being really powerful spokespeople to global leaders, to their own country's leaders, about the importance of investing in TB.
Now, Dick, you mentioned one of the key reasons for the spread of tuberculosis is the HIV epidemic. Why are the two of those together really just fanning the flame of the TB epidemic?
Well, tuberculosis is an infection that's usually controlled by the immune system. And as I mentioned, most people who are infected with the organism don't get sick. Only a minority do. But the immune system is the target of HIV infection, and people with HIV become immunodeficient. That is, their immune system no longer functions properly. And as they progress in their HIV infection, they become more and more susceptible to tuberculosis. In those areas of the world where HIV is most epidemic, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, but also in Southeast Asia, tuberculosis infection is exceedingly common. In South Africa and in the southern parts of Africa, upwards of 50% of the entire population is infected with tuberculosis. When HIV enters that setting, it creates a disaster scenario where half of the people with HIV are at very high risk of becoming sick with tuberculosis. And as you noted, it's now the leading cause of death in people with HIV.
Now, it might be good at this point for you to explain the difference between active and latent TB. So when you say that portion of the population in Africa is actually infected with the bacillus, that's latent, correct? And then HIV would make that turn into active? Or can you just explain what that process is?
That's correct. So most people get infected with tuberculosis. It's inhaled through the lungs, spread by somebody who's sick with the disease. And the infection is contained by the immune system. And so most people who are infected with TB have no idea that they are and aren't sick from it. And that's latent tuberculosis. People can continue to be infected with tuberculosis for the rest of their life and will always be at risk of getting sick from it. But as I noted, most people don't. Active tuberculosis is when the immune system no longer holds the bug in check, and it begins to multiply and cause disease. When people get infected with HIV, their risk of developing TB doubles almost immediately and then continues to climb. And over time, a very high proportion of people who are infected with both organisms will become sick with tuberculosis.
Now, Irene, you mentioned the DOTS program and how that's the foundation of one of the foundations of this new plan. Tell us, what is DOTS and how effectively is it working?
Well, DOTS is essentially a strategy. It's that has been in place for the last maybe decade, perhaps. And it has five components, the first one being strong political commitment, because if without political commitment at the country level and actually internationally, you very little can actually get done. The second component is a standardized regimen of, and in previous iterations, it had been of directly observed therapy. That has evolved a little bit, and now it's of supervised treatment, so that there is somebody with the patient to make sure they take the drugs, whether it be a family member, whether it be a healthcare worker, a community worker. It can be any number of different approaches can be used, depending on the patient and the community. The third area is a insured supply of drugs to make sure that there are sufficient drugs for the patient for the entire course of treatment. Because as you mentioned in your opening remarks, what is incredibly important is that patients do stay on treatment for the entire course of treatment. Another area is monitoring and evaluation. The TB system has for some time had in place a very detailed monitoring and evaluation system that are used at the healthcare sites to report back and to make sure that each patient is diagnosed, follows the protocols for diagnosis, but then also tracks that patient throughout the course of treatment. That information is rolled up into a global surveillance plan. One of the things that DOTS strategy has evolved over the last couple of years, and the global plan for TB does talk about the DOTS being the basis, but there are another five elements that have been added. One is addressing TB and multi-drug resistant TB and TB-HIV. Another area is empowering patients and communities to stay on treatment. It's also talking about research and making sure that there is investments in research as well. And it also involves takes the language into a slightly broader definition to make it much more patient-centered, if you will, as we go forward. If you want to add anything to that, Joanne.
Yeah. Well, can you give me some examples, Joanne, maybe we could start with you, of where DOTS has been successful? I know you just recently got back from Kenya.
Well, and I'd love to talk about that, particularly in the context, I know we're going to also talk about TB in Africa, but I think one really great example of, you know, still further to go, but remarkable progress is in India. India scaled up their DOTS program starting around, in a serious way, around 1998. They've increased the coverage some more than 50-fold, so more than 50 times. They've trained something like 400,000 health workers. They bring 100,000 people into treatment every month, and they've essentially achieved what they would consider 100% national coverage, which does not mean that every person with TB is getting treatment, but that all of their centers actually have DOTS. And when they instituted the DOTS program and they looked at comparing before and after, their cure rates have gone up from something like 25 or 30% to over 80%. So it's had a huge impact in India, which has the largest number of TB cases in the world.
We actually got an email from India. You talked about some of the indicators that show success, but she had a specific question about how is progress determined in a TB prevention and treatment program, especially in large countries like India, where large numbers go unreported? Furthermore, what are the indicators of success, and what are these indicators a function of? Lorraine?
Within every, as I mentioned, there is a TB monitoring and evaluation system in place. There are two main indicators that are used internationally for TB. One is the case detection rate. There are estimates of the number of cases based on epidemiological modeling and others and surveys done in the past. So the question is how many patients have been on treatment, have been identified, diagnosed, and put on treatment. What proportion of the estimated numbers are done? And those estimates are done at a national level, but they can also be done at a local level or district level. So that's one indicator, and that tells you how well the TB program is in finding patients and putting them on treatment and getting them on treatment. The second indicator, which is equally important, is the treatment success rate. And that's what's and also one element of that is the cure rate. And what happens at the end of treatment and how many of those patients are being cured. Those are two of the main indicators that are followed for TB and are incredibly important. Those are the ones we track at a global level as well as a national local level. Other elements of the system also looks at dropout rate, failure rate, death, and those, particularly the failure rate, is something we watch particularly carefully in dropout rates. If you want, the failure rate will tell you whether or not you have some multi-drug resistant TB or resistant or TB that's resistant to some of the drugs, and dropout rate will tell you something about the strength of the program and whether there's problems with patients adhering to treatment overall.
Now, I think both of you actually mentioned that this doesn't necessarily account for those who have tuberculosis but don't get treated, which leads That's to right. the issue of improving diagnostics. So, Dick, could you just please give us an assessment of the current state of TB diagnostics and what really is needed to improve the state of diagnostics?
I'd be happy to, but I'd like to just add one other important word about what the measures are. If we only count the number of people diagnosed and cured, we don't pay attention to how prevalent the disease is. And an important goal is to reduce the number of cases. We don't want to have the case rate continually climbing. Even if we can treat and cure most of those patients, it's still not a good thing. So we need to drive the rate of tuberculosis down. And that's why the Millennium Development Goals of the UN are so important, because they set very ambitious targets to reduce the prevalence of TB by 50% and deaths from TB by 50% over the next 10 years. And I think that's really what everything else should be focused on.
So should we maybe start there then before we get to diagnostics? What will it take then to reduce those prevalence rates?
Well, the new global plan is quite specific in laying out the targets for what kind of performance we need in all of the areas that we've been talking about, DOTS expansion, number of cases treated, and so forth, but also in the development of new tools. And it also contains a bill for the cost of doing all of this of about $55 billion. So that's what it's going to take. It's a massive effort, and I'm very glad that Irene is in charge of it, the chair of the coordinating board, because...
You can't see her, but she's raising her, putting her finger up, saying that she wants to say something, so I can see why you're glad she's in charge of it. Go ahead, Irene.
Thanks, Dick. One of the other, in addition to what Dick just said, because the plan, the global plan is exactly what that is all about. It is about reducing death rates and reducing prevalence over the year, and that is exactly what the objectives are. But what it also does, in addition to what Dick talked about, it lays out at the region by region, what needs to happen. And what's also very clear is because of HIV, we will not achieve the targets in Africa. Because no matter what, we can pull out all the stops, and we will make huge progress, but there's going to still be a lot of work to be done because of the HIV epidemic. And the same thing is true in Eastern Europe because of multi-drug resistant TB. And Eastern Europe is where we see the highest rates and most of the multi-drug resistant TB. Globally, we will achieve those goals of cutting prevalence in half and cutting deaths due to TB in half from the 1990 targets. But we need to continue our efforts in Asia and in Latin America and in the Western Pacific and others. But the work in Africa is still a lot of work to be done, the same thing in Eastern Europe.
And I might only add that the price tag sounds really high. You know, you talk about $56 billion over the next decade. But in fact, the gap is a little over $3 billion a year. And when you think, number one, that right now a lot of the investments being done by poor countries themselves, and that if we could actually cut prevalence in half, cut death rates in half, and come up with new tools, you know, in some cases for the first time, you know, in 30 or 40 years, for a little over $3 billion a year, I mean, that sounds like a great investment to me for one of the biggest global killers. So it's actually a relatively small amount, and we could have a huge impact.
So now we're kind of into the question of political will. And is there enough political will out here to raise the gap is $31 billion. So on the day that the plan was announced at the World Economic Forum, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation said that it was going to triple its funding for tuberculosis control to $900 million by 2015. And the UK announced more than $71 million to India for its TB control program. And then recently, the G8 finance minister said they were working on a plan to help jumpstart vaccines for developing nation diseases. So it sounds like there might be at least some political will out there, but is it enough? I don't know who wants to take that one first.
I think one of the challenges we really face is that despite the fact that this disease kills 2 million people a year, you know, as Dick was pointing out, literally 1 in 3 people on the planet are carrying it as a latent infection. I think that there's often a sense among policymakers that it's not a huge problem anymore, that it's something that we were familiar with in a lot of the wealthier countries 30 or 40, 50 years ago, and people may be a little bit aware that there was a resurgence certainly in the early 90s in the U.S., but we have this sense that it's not, it's kind of a background problem, that it's not a huge issue anymore. So part of it is just awareness, and I think the power of this global plan and this launch is partly that it really is a blueprint. You know, it's a plan of action for what we can do in the next decade. But it's also to just increase our awareness that this thing, you know, has not gone away. And in fact, it's really resurgent, and particularly in places like Africa where it's being driven by HIV. So number one, just being that what we're doing right now, what the plan's done, the launch, is all really important, because a lot of it's just awareness. Nobody is in favor of TB. They just honestly don't know. I mean, that's my experience with policymakers over and over, is that most of them are not aware. And when they understand the level of the problem, they want to do something. The U.S. Congress, in the case of the U.S., has increased funding from, you know, almost $0 a decade ago to about $90 million a year, but it's been kind of flatlined the last few years. So I think we've really seen an increase in U.S. government awareness, investment in AIDS, and now in malaria. And I think TB is the next huge frontier where we could have a huge impact. So I think we're kind of on the cusp of the next level. And so the answer is we don't have enough political will. Most TB deaths in the world, the fact that we don't have new tools, are more at this point really a reflection of lack of political will and awareness than they are lack of knowing what to do next. But I think the fact that the, you know, Chancellor of the UK, Gordon Brown's talking about it, I think the fact that the President of Nigeria is calling for more action, I mean, those are really encouraging things. We need to really build on it, because we're not there yet.
Just add to that, because Joanne is absolutely right. Because action needs to happen not only among the donor community, and the pool of it does need to happen there, and more so than it has been. The pool of donors contributing to international TB is fairly small, and that desperately needs to be expanded. But there also needs to be action and commitment and resources at the country level as well. There are a lot of resources at the country level. There are a lot of resources from the private sector at the country level and from governments that can be devoted to TB. So it's not only up to the donors themselves to come up with this $31 billion. It is everybody working together, and that is one of the messages of the plan, is that it is through this collective action that we can make it happen. So we need to look for new sources of funding, whether it be from the private sector, foundations, and others. Foundations, particularly the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, have done a huge amount for TB, but there is more to be done.
Dick, what is your sense? Your organization, CREATE, works on a lot of clinical trials in these countries that are burdened by TB. What is your sense of their political will, the country's actual political will, to combat TB?
Well, I think the level of will varies and I think it's improved enormously in the last several years. But tuberculosis, unlike some of the other major diseases, particularly HIV, really still sort of suffers from a lack of attention, a lack of awareness, and doesn't have the same political forces aligned against it as HIV does. And that, I think, is a major challenge to overcome. You were asking earlier about engaging patients into the battle, and I think that's been one of the problems. AIDS advocacy has been led by people with HIV who are aware that they have HIV for life, and if something isn't done about it, the consequences can be dire. Tuberculosis patients are usually unaware that they're infected before they become sick. They become sick, and their goal is to become an ex-tuberculosis patient as fast as possible. And in the majority of instances, that's what happens, and they go back to life as normal and tend not to view themselves as tuberculosis patients anymore. Getting more patient advocacy is really, I think, going to be important for generating the political will that's necessary. I do a lot of work in Brazil, and in Brazil, HIV activists have been very effective, but there hasn't been a corresponding TB activism that's pressured the government there to do a better job in responding to TB.
Now, that getting activists prepared, that is also part of a global plan as well, correct? How do you see that manifesting itself in the global plan?
I think it's a hugely important component. It's, again, mobilizing broad sectors of society, both activists and advocates in this country and in other wealthy countries, but also particularly in countries themselves. So in the ways that we've seen, you know, two things, social mobilization and political mobilization in countries around around AIDS, around, you know, polio eradication campaigns, I mean, the kind of social mobilization that happened around that. And so there's explicitly within the global plan, there's resources for advocacy and for social mobilization. And I really believe that a really important component for that is actually supporting networks of patient activists in the countries where they live to actually be advocates with their government, with the media, to get out the word on this issue. And that is a specific component of the plan.
While we're on the communications topic, I think we have answered this question, but I just want to see if you all have anything else to add. This is actually from someone at Stop TB, wanting to know, in your opinion, and this is for all of the participants on our panel, in your opinion, what are the main communications challenges in raising awareness on the global TB burden, and what needs to be done to address these challenges?
Mr. I think there's a whole range of things, and every time we talk about it, we seem to talk about an issue within the coordinating board or the partnership forum, communications and advocacy comes up as one of the things that needs to be done. A lot of the issues are the ones we've been talking about. As Joanne said earlier, there is this general notion that TB is no longer a problem. It's, you know, it's a problem of the developing world, maybe, and only if you raise it to somebody's attention do they start to realize how much of a problem it is. People are often surprised that it is 2 million people die every year because of TB. That's not a widely known statistic, and I think there needs to be a lot more work done on getting that message out and getting a message about exactly how big the burden is. But the other important message is that there is something that can be done about TB. It is a treatable illness. The treatment is not easy. It's a six-month course of treatment, but it can be done. We have the tools, and what we need is the political will to get there. There are a whole range of other communication issues, particularly at the country level, about that have to do with stigma, have to do with getting patients to stay on treatment, to not be afraid to come in for testing, and to accept the diagnosis and stay on treatment, that do vary from country to country and are things we really do need to address. But those are some of the basic ones that I would see.
No, just again to reiterate, when the U.S. Centers for Disease Control did like a public survey in this country, that's exactly what they found. People said, I didn't think that was a problem anymore. So that's sort of the basic one. But I also think, a communications challenge is to realize that this is not, we're not in the situation we're in simply because this is a bad disease or because it is inevitable. There's lots of things that we can do in terms of treatment right now. We're at a really exciting place with regards to the development of new drugs, new diagnostics, new vaccines. But we're in this place where we are right now in terms of not being further along, in part because there's been a systematic underinvestment in this for years. So we've ignored this for a long time. Countries have been, you know, kind of puttering away, doing really good work to scale up their programs, but kind of under the radar screen. And it's really only been in the last 5, 6, 7 years that there's been this real flourishing of opportunities around new tools. But, you know, we haven't had a new drug for almost 40 years. In most, you know, and Dick can say more about this, but in most of the poor countries, the diagnostic test we're using for TB is over 100 years old. And that's just a kind of systematic, you know, I think we don't realize that we could be in a very different place if we could make these kind of investments in the next decade. We could have a huge leap, you know, really a quantum leap in where we are. This is not at all inevitable.
Dick, could you just kind of give us an idea, correct me if I'm wrong, it's 22 countries shoulder 80% of the TB burden. What do people in these countries struggle with in terms of the outdated diagnostics and the laborious treatment? Can you just give an idea of kind of what the state is of diagnostics and of treatment right now?
The diagnosis of tuberculosis is based on identifying the bugs, usually in sputum, what the patients cough out of their lungs. And as Joanne just mentioned, the diagnostic test that we used is the one that was developed by Robert Koch in 1882 when he discovered tuberculosis, and that's the standard used around the world. And it's a terrible test because it misses well over half of the cases. So we really need much better diagnostic tests. We can grow the organism in a culture, but that takes 3 to 4 weeks, and most countries don't have well-developed laboratory systems that are capable of doing that for most patients. So they rely on the old smear test, looking at the sputum, and end up missing many cases. We can do x-rays, but x-rays can't distinguish tuberculosis from cancer, from other forms of pneumonia, so it's not a particularly reliable test. And then there are new tests that are used for many other infections in developed countries, polymerase chain reaction or PCR-based tests that are available for tuberculosis but are technically demanding and expensive. So if you go to a country like India or a country like Nigeria or any of the other 22 high-burden countries, most patients are evaluated by coughing up sputum, which is stained and looked at under a microscope. And if they see the bugs using these special stains developed in 1882, they're diagnosed. And if they don't see the bugs, which is half of the cases, they're not diagnosed.
And isn't it also true, Dick, that it's a particular, I mean, the place where we have the highest, you know, the largest number of TB cases in the world, if you're kind of looking at the map, are Asia, but the highest rates of TB are in Africa driven by HIV. And that's also, isn't it true that the sort of existing diagnostic test will be even more likely to miss people who are HIV positive? So, and also given that those are folks that are liable to die very quickly from active TB once it's activated, it's a double challenge and doubly important to be aggressive in that area. But I don't know if you'd say more about that.
Right. People with HIV are much more likely to have tuberculosis that spreads outside the lungs, so they have disease that can't be diagnosed from a sputum test. And when it is in the lungs, which it still frequently is, they're less likely to have a positive sputum test. So they're much harder to diagnose. They have higher rates. It's harder to diagnose it. It's often outside the lungs, and as you say, it is more rapidly lethal, and thus many patients actually die of tuberculosis without ever being diagnosed.
Also seems if we could get, you know, thinking about the new tools, you know, if we could get a drug developed and then, you know, a new drug regimen where you could treat someone in 2 months or a month instead of 6 months, I mean, just the impact on healthcare workers' time, patient adherence. I mean, you know, it's hard enough to take 10 days worth of antibiotics, right? But, you know, 6 months to 8 months. So just the impact that could have in, you know, in so many areas on health systems, but just on patients being able, likely to complete treatment.
And there's quite a bit of exciting development in both of these arenas in terms of diagnostics and treatment as well. Irene, I don't know if you want to talk about that, and maybe Dick, you can add as well.
Dick, I hopefully can talk a little bit more about the details, but what is laid out in the plan is that we do expect there to be new developments in diagnostics available for the field in the next, over the next 5 years, and for both drugs and diagnostics, and a new drug to be available by 2010, which will be the first new drug in 40 years. So that will be quite an exciting development. The issue on diagnostics, I think we're not quite ready to, you know, what what we want for a diagnostic is something that is easy to read, it's cheap, it can be read at the field level, at the point of contact with a patient, at the most peripheral level, something that's accurate and very easy to read. That is still some ways away, and I don't know, Dick, if you can say a little bit more about that, but that's a little bit more of our gold standard where we are.
Yeah, there's a lot of very exciting research going on, both in diagnostics and in drugs. And I think we have to be extremely imaginative and bold and set very high standards and then go after them. With the diagnostic tests, we were complacent for decades using these old antiquated methods that just don't perform well enough. And there are new technologies coming along and new approaches that are under study right now that are very exciting. There are new ways of growing the bug, culturing the bug, where it can be done in less than a week. And that's a big improvement over a month. We still would like to be able to do it within an hour, but I'll take a week over a month any day. In terms of drugs, there is a class of drugs, the fluoroquinolones, which are widely used for other infections, which happen to have extremely good activity against tuberculosis, and we're now involved in a number of studies looking at one of those drugs, moxifloxacin, which appears to have great potential and could result in a much shorter course of treatment for tuberculosis within the next several years. And that's just the first step. There are other drugs in the pipeline that are following along. So I think there's reason for a lot of optimism. There's a lot of difficult work to be done, but things are moving in the right direction.
And just a few more scientific details before we move on to more viewer questions. Dick, can you talk about the BCG vaccine? And it's obviously still being used, but obviously it's not stemming the spread of TB. So can you talk about the vaccine and how effective it is, but why there's a need to develop another vaccine?
Well, BCG is the tuberculosis vaccine. It's a live vaccine. It's made from live bacteria that are taken from Mycobacterium bovis, which is the bug that causes TB in cattle. So it's not the human form of the organism. But it was developed in 1919 at the Pasteur Institute. So like everything else in tuberculosis, it's ancient. And though it worked very well early on in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and even up into the 60s, it has evolved because it's a live vaccine. It has changed as it's been cultured over the decades. And it appears from the last three major studies of it that were done over the last 25 years that it does not protect adults from tuberculosis. Ironically, it's the most widely used vaccine in the world, with over 100 million people a year receiving it. And the rationale at this point for using it is that it appears to protect young children from the more severe forms of TB, which can be devastating in childhood. It certainly doesn't protect adults from tuberculosis, and it's having no impact on tuberculosis control globally. So even if it does protect children, which is a very good thing, it's not contributing to the battle against TB at the global level, and so we need something better. The good thing is we know it can be done because it was done before. BCG used to work, but because it's a living organism that's grown in laboratories around the world and cultured over and over again, it's unfortunately mutated itself into ineffectiveness.
Irene, earlier you mentioned that the global plan also divides up specific plans regionally. And two of those very important regions are Eastern Europe and Africa. So I'd like to just touch base a little bit on both of those. Mm-hmm. Last year, the WHO declared the TB situation in Africa an emergency. Why has it gotten to that point in Africa, and what are some elements of the specific plan to combat that?
It was actually not WHO that declared it. It was the health ministers of Africa that declared it a regional emergency, recognizing how serious the TB pandemic is in Africa. And it is partly, Africa is the one region where we have incident rates going up, where in every other region they are coming down. In Africa, they continue to go up, partly because of HIV/AIDS. And the plan divides Africa into countries with high HIV and low HIV, because there is a different, the epidemic is progressing differently in both those sets of countries. But in part, there's a lot of issues. It's like we are, as Joanne mentioned, that Africa is where we have the highest rates of TB. You know, in some communities, it's upper, 900 per 100,000 cases, which in the U.S., it's, Dick or Joanne, correct me, it's less than 10 or something.
Yeah, it's between 5 and 6 or 6, about 6.
So, and we tend to cut at 100 per 100,000 is a very high rate. But if you have these communities, which tend to be communities with high HIV at 900, it's an amazingly high rate of TB, and it's very frightening for those communities in particular. But it's also in Africa we have, and one of the reasons TB is such an issue in Africa is that we have a healthcare system that is not functioning as well. It's in part because of neglect over the many years. The HIV epidemic has also had an impact on the healthcare system in Africa. But the two combined are working together to make it very difficult for effective TB treatment to get to all those who need it. And we're seeing that over and over again in country after country. We talked a little while ago about the issues around diagnosis, and the tools we have are blunt at the best for diagnosis. But then you add to that a system where normally it may take a couple weeks for a slide to come back as having been cultured, and places in Africa you don't have no place to send that slide for culture. I mean, the labs that can do that are so far away, and there's no transport, it just can't happen. So you've got these logistical and infrastructure issues that just make TB control even more difficult in places like that. In Eastern Europe, one of the issues we have there is prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, the Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union system was a very strong, centrally controlled system with lots of investment. With the fall of the Soviet Union, those investments went away, and the practices that were in place were actually very old practices. By trying to adapt to new practices and putting in place a system that doesn't rely on the same kinds of investments in the health infrastructure that you had prior to the fall of the Soviet Union has resulted in there's a lot of drugs available, so you've got a lot of drugs that are not used well, so you have very, very high rates of multi-drug resistance. And there are issues around political commitment in Eastern Europe, and there are a couple of countries that have made TB a high priority, and you're seeing the results of that in improvements in TB, but other countries that have not. And that is one of the big challenges we have in the partnership for the coming years.
In terms of Africa, I don't know if you'd like to add anything else, because I know that the focus of results, one of the big focuses is poverty. How does poverty play into the cyclical nature of poverty in TB?
Well, maybe I say that a little bit on that broadly, and then maybe coming back to the Africa issue, just organizationally, we actually got involved in the TB issue really as a poverty issue, because TB is a huge public health problem, but it's also a huge consequence of poverty in that it's very poor people who are particularly, like poor countries, but then very poor people in poor countries who are particularly impacted by TB, who also may be the least likely to have access to health services. But it's also a huge cause of poverty, because it hits people in the ages between 15 and 45 in particular. So it's the breadwinners in families, it's parents. And so it'll really push people who maybe are just surviving, push them right over the edge into deeper poverty, because they can't work, because they're spending what money they do have to try to get health care, even though in a lot of countries, TB treatment is actually free. So it's a really huge cause of poverty, and it's linked to that. In terms of Africa, just maybe a couple other comments. One is, if you look at the next decade in terms of the global plan, Africa is not only the place with the highest rates and the place where TB is still growing, it also has the largest funding gap. So it's the place where we need to really do the most as a global community to really address the TB problem. And I guess what I would say on the positive side, and what I just saw, I was literally just in Kenya a couple of weeks ago and in the slums of Nairobi, and what was really encouraging to me is people are getting treatment. There's healthcare workers that are getting out there, and people are getting their TB treatment. And it's probably, until we can get ARVs to everyone, it's probably the most powerful thing we can be doing to keep people with AIDS alive, because it's the number one killer of people with HIV/AIDS. And the other thing that I think is exciting, and again, Dick could say more about this, but one of the huge challenges we face everywhere with HIV, but particularly in Africa, so many people don't know their status and aren't even into the system to get antiretrovirals or other things that could keep people with AIDS alive and healthier. The TB programs in many cases are the best entry point of getting people into the system. One program I was at said they doubled, went from 400 to 800 people actually in the AIDS treatment system by being really aggressive about getting people with TB tested for HIV. So it can be a really powerful way to actually improve the situation for people with HIV who are co-infected as well.
Dick, we actually had an email about that same issue, basically bridging the divide between TB and HIV. This is from Jakarta. So can you talk about, because I know you've done a lot of work on this at CREATE, can you talk about how you are trying to bridge that divide between TB and HIV?
Well, we're trying to address it in several ways. The first is through a programmatic approach. Countries tend to have separate programs for TB and HIV, and over the last decade, each has viewed the other as a source of distress. The AIDS program doesn't want to be thinking about tuberculosis because they have their own problems, and TB is just too big an issue to tackle. And the tuberculosis programs consider that HIV is something that just saps their strength, undermines their workers, and you know they'd rather not have to deal with it. And so you've had programs that exist within the same health departments that really have not interdigitated very well, and they need to do a lot more to work together. So that's the first approach, bringing these programs together. As Joanne pointed out, people in tuberculosis clinics need HIV services. It's an excellent entry point because in Kenya, in other places in Africa, 50, 60, 70% of all tuberculosis patients also have HIV. So that's one way to do it. The other way is through clinical interventions that can access patients who have tuberculosis but probably also have HIV and therefore can get them into treatment and get them on antiretrovirals if that's indicated. And providing TB clinical services to people with HIV, giving preventive therapy. We can prevent tuberculosis with a simple antibiotic. It's recommended by the World Health Organization, and hardly anybody anywhere in the world receives it. That's one of the important challenges.
Dick, we actually had an email about that. You know, what are some prevention methods? So you say that hardly anyone gets the treatment, and it's a simple antibiotic. What can be done to actually get the treatment in the hands of these people?
Well, we really need to change policies, and we need to change the attitudes of clinicians who provide care. The antibiotic isoniazid, which was one of the first drugs developed for tuberculosis, can be given to people who have latent TB, not active, and it prevents the development of latent TB, and it's upwards of 90% effective. It's been shown that it works very well in people with HIV, but it's not something that has been widely adopted throughout the world where it's needed. That's one of the main issues that CREATE is working on, is documenting and demonstrating the impact that TB preventive therapy has in reducing rates of tuberculosis.
Did you want to add something?
Just one quick policy point. I think, you know, we should come back to, you know, what can the U.S. do? But one particularly related to this issue, I think as a lot of people know, the U.S. has launched a major AIDS initiative in a number of high HIV burden countries. There's a huge role that could play by doing more on TB-HIV coordination. Like for instance, in Kenya, there's a lot of really progressive work that's being done there, but it's not being done systematically. So if the President's AIDS Initiative can really systematically do more on TB and HIV, that could have a huge policy and financial impact of really helping ensure that those programs are coordinated in the way that Dick was talking about.
What's been the impact of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria in all of this? Rain, do you want to start with that?
It's been huge. I mean, for the first time, you do have a huge amount of money going toward TB as well as HIV and malaria as well, which is hugely important at the country level. What we need to do is make sure there continues to be a global fund, and I think that's incumbent on all donors to make sure we continue to that. The U.S. has made huge commitments to the global fund, and we'll hopefully continue that, but other donors do need to come to the table and maintain their commitments as well, because we are now, hopefully there will be a round six for the global fund. The last round that was grants given last year, TB did very well. There were a lot of grants given for TB, and part of that was a real effort on the part of the Stop TB Partnership and others to work with the countries to make sure that the proposals put forward were good proposals, and it certainly paid off. But the Global Fund the impact is tremendous.
In the $56 million over 10 years, is Global Fund money included in that?
Yes, absolutely.
The Global Fund actually has provided, it's actually quite remarkable, it's sort of changed the TB world in terms of countries having money to do this work. It actually is providing two-thirds of the external funding, so beyond what countries are doing themselves, it's providing two-thirds of the external funding for TB, and to continue to be able to do that, hugely important. So the U.S., other donors have to really provide their fair share so that we at least have around this year, around next year. If we lost that, it would be a huge loss to the TB community and malaria and AIDS, but particularly TB and malaria.
I'd like to get to a few more viewer emails, one that's kind of on the same subject from the United Kingdom. What sectors of society not currently involved to the level they could be will be critical to bring on board for the plan to be successful?
It's hard to imagine what sectors shouldn't be involved in, because a lot of what we're talking about is work at the community level, and where you do have the education systems, you know, where to get messages around TB out through the schools and supporting parents. It is through the private sectors we've talked about before, both the medical private sector, making sure private providers, medical providers and clinicians are connecting with the public sector TB program. There is the Stop TB Partnership and WHO are just about to issue the International Standards of Care for, which is aimed primarily at private providers, but to make sure everybody is using the same approaches to TB and that there is the standardized regimens that you do see in standardized approaches for TB that are followed by all providers, whether they be in the public sector or the private sector. The companion document to that is the patient's charter, which is the other area of society that, as Joanne talked about, we are getting more engagement with, and the TB patient community has really tried to have a much more active voice, and I think there's a lot more to do in that. But there is, community groups, the religious communities have been, the Catholic Church and other religions have been involved in TB. They are often the ones delivering services at the rural levels. And they are ones we can really partner with and can do a lot for TB. So it's hard to imagine any sector that shouldn't be working on this. I mean, this really is a plan to bring everybody together toward the same goal.
No, I mean, I think I don't have much to add. But I think also, in the same way AIDS has become an issue that even ordinary citizens weigh in on, I mean, there's some of that, even in people that work in my own organization and others. But I think more broadly, again, this issue is, people are dying, and this issue is sort of in some ways languished for lack of political attention. So I think also the ordinary citizens, the activists, the certainly patient activists themselves, but it is the celebrities, it's the political leaders. I mean, we have to bring that whole community at a level where we have this plan. We could really turn this epidemic around very rapidly with that kind of involvement and the kind of bottom-up involvement as well.
I would just add that I think getting the legislatures of the world involved. There's a lot of and growing interest in government, obviously, but I've not sensed much of a demand from the people's representatives, the legislators of the world, demanding increasing and improving services and so forth. And I think that would be very powerful.
No, absolutely, and also demanding an increase in resources. I mean, I would say, it has been in the last, decade, the U.S. Congress that's driven the funding that we do have on TB, but I think we need to ramp that up at a level of demand that's really commensurate with the problem.
We had another email about stigma. We talked about that a little bit earlier, but just to be a little bit more in depth, this is from France. What concrete steps are being made to address the problems of stigma, in particular the deep-rooted prejudice against people with TB that is institutionalized within systems and programs that the Global Plan 2 seeks to expand? How much of a problem is stigma, and then what is being done to combat it?
Well, I'll make a comment about it. Stigma is a huge problem, and it's different in different parts of the world, which makes it very difficult to address. What's happening throughout Africa now is that there's a new form of stigma associated with tuberculosis. So tuberculosis used to be stigmatizing because it meant you were poor and dirty, but now it's stigmatizing because it means you have AIDS. And that's a very difficult stigma to fight. I think what has been very powerful in helping with that is the expansion of treatment of HIV. And as antiviral drugs are made available, as people can get treated for HIV and it's no longer seen as an automatic death sentence, then that will help reduce stigma. And the stigma associated with having tuberculosis might also be reduced. But it's a big problem, and it's different in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing the clinics in South Africa, and there's posters that say Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu had tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. But, you know, also one of the studies that was done in India, they talked about over 100,000 women being rejected by their families every year because they had tuberculosis. And so it's a huge issue, you know, in manifesting in various ways. I think it's in part patients having the support to be public about these issues, you know, TB patients and kind of talking about tuberculosis. I think it's really getting out the word that this is curable. It's very curable, very treatable. And also, you know, the more that we can have, in addition to patient activists, sort of leader celebrities and others speak out, so this becomes less of an issue of people that are poor, people that are marginalized, you know, and more of a public issue in the same way we've moved the HIV epidemic.
I could just also add to that, it is very much, it's a huge issue. I mean, as Dick said, we are, one of the concrete things where I think we can do and we are doing within the Stop TB Partnership, there is an element of the Advocacy and Social Mobilization Working Group has a part of it is focusing on social mobilization at the country level. And as Dick said, it does vary, and the issues around stigma change from one country to another. But it does mean that every country really does need to have a clear plan about advocacy, social mobilization, and communication, which deals with stigma. And stigma is one of the high priorities that the plan has put forward to deal with at the country level. And it really does need to be tailored to certain circumstances, but it absolutely must be addressed.
One last issue I'd like for us to discuss before we wrap it up is the issue of brain drain. We just got an email from Maryland about brain drain. Do the next steps for TB include measures to encourage and keep providers practicing in the developing world, which also leads to the question of health systems infrastructures, which we touched on a little bit earlier, but I don't think as much as we needed to. So can we just maybe address both of these issues now? How can health infrastructures in developing countries be improved and then also retain healthcare workers?
This is a huge issue. We were talking a little bit about a while ago about Africa and what is thought about for Africa and what the plan is. One of the big issues for Africa, and one of the part of the roadmap, if you will, as we've talked about it for Africa, is looking at some of these broad fundamental issues around human resources, retaining people in country, giving them, building incentives into the system that make people want to stay in country and do the work there rather than having to look for jobs outside of the country. It is an issue that is not unique to TB at all. It cuts across all health issues, particularly in Africa. So one of the things we have been trying to do is work with other organizations in Africa, such as the African Union and the Economic Commission for Africa and others, to come together on what kinds of interventions can we collectively do and work together on to address these issues. These are fundamental. There is no easy solution because they're macroeconomic issues that there is no silver bullet to deal with this, but it's something we absolutely have to take on.
I would say just on a policy level, one really important issue related to this that we do have to wrestle with is, without getting too complex on it, the International Monetary Fund works with governments of countries and sets overall budgetary and spending ceilings, and public health people across the spectrum are telling me now that there's actually more money going into public health, these IMF ceilings on hiring and on wages and on spending are really making it difficult sometimes to, for countries to actually spend the money that they do get coming in. So we really need to address, as part of that systematic problem, we really need to address ways that we can make sure that when money is available, people can be hired and they can be paid so they do stay in the country and that they don't leave.
One of the things that drives people away from developing countries and to the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere to practice medicine or nursing or what have you, beyond opportunity and money, is sense of futility. And if you work in a system where you feel like you can't save anybody, you can't get anything done, it's discouraging. And as the PEPFAR programs, as the Global Fund programs are pumping huge amounts of resources into countries and allowing them to do things that are cutting-edge medicine in the West, it's creating opportunity, hope, and it's crushing the futility that had previously been there. So I think that might help retain a lot of the brains that would otherwise be drained.
We actually got several emails from clinicians in developing countries asking questions about specific TB cases. What resources would you recommend for them? I don't know if there's a list of best practices. Some of it was regarding multiple drug-resistant TB, others latent TB. Where could these folks go? Because clearly they have access to a computer if they're able to email us. So are there websites out there, WHO, CDC? Dick, where would you send people in developing countries for information on TB?
Well, their own national guidelines are probably available on the web, but probably the best resource would be the CDC Division of Tuberculosis Elimination website. And so if you go to cdc.gov and navigate your way to tuberculosis, there are enormous numbers of links and there are enormous numbers of training tools and other resources that are very useful. The statements of the American Thoracic Society on tuberculosis prevention, treatment, and care. So cdc.gov, and from there find your way to the TB Elimination Bureau, or division rather, and their website is a great resource.
In addition, the WHO website, which is WHO.int, I believe, and the Stop TB, which is StopTB.org, both have access to. There are guidelines on MDR-TB as well as TB and HIV and a number of other things that have been internationally accepted and recognized that they can get access to, in addition to this CDC website.
Irene Cook, Dick Chasen, and Joanne Carter, thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks to all of you for your questions. If you'd like to read the Global Plan to Stop TB, we've included a link to it on the Ask the Experts website. Thanks again so much for tuning in. I'm Jill Braden-Balderas with KaiserNetwork.org.